colloquium talk and also the beginning of the stay of our 10th distinguished chair, the first one at UBC, Mr. David Bridges, who will be introduced by Gordon. Let me just remind you of this position. We have one at each of the five Kim's founding universities each year, a distinguished chair who comes to lecture and give a mini course over the course of a month or possibly longer time. This is supported by the Pacific Institute, and it's a pilot program that's just begun. And I'm quite looking forward to it. Professor Bridges will give four lectures on self-voiding blocks, differential forms, lecture one. That'll be on Tuesday, September 15th, is that correct? That's today, right? Sorry, lecture two is Tuesday, September 19th. Mailer's formula in the renormalization group, and then another one September 26th and October 4th. They'll be in the notices. I won't write all that down now. Gordon, you can introduce the speaker.
Before I introduce the speaker, let me just say that we're going to continue the tradition this year following the colloquium of going over to the Graduate Center for a drink, and everyone's welcome to join. It's a special pleasure for me to introduce David Bridges, who's the Commonwealth Professor at the University of Virginia. David has made numerous insightful and important contributions to mathematical physics, especially to quantum field theory and statistical mechanics. Some of you will remember when he was here in 1984 and told us of his new invention at the time, the Lace expansion, which was used to prove, understand the behavior of self-pointing blocks in more than five dimensions. And for the last 16 years, there's been a small industry associated with developing his ideas further. More recently, he has been developing an elegant and mathematically rigorous implementation of the renormalization group, and has been applying it now to the four-dimensional self-avoiding block problem, and he's going to be telling us about that work in this series of four lectures. So the first lecture today is self-avoiding block and differential forms.
Well, I thank you very much for this wonderful invitation. It was a good day in my life when it first arrived because it was my birthday. And not only did this invitation come to talk, but also my daughter decided I needed waking up a bit and took me off to a concert by The Who in the evening. And although there should be a law against people like that doing this kind of thing after they reach this sort of age, they were actually pretty good. So I recommend them. I'll just put up here, let me get these out. This is the first of several lectures, but they are independent, because I know that nobody nowadays can remember what happened more than a few minutes ago, at least I can't. And sorry, let me get out of your way here. Is there a thing I can point with? I'll try. Okay, well, never mind. That's what I'll be doing. Today, I'm going to show you how problems in self-avoiding walk have some connection to Gaussian integrals in very high dimensions. And then you can forget about that if you want, because next time it'll be how you evaluate Gaussian integrals in very high dimension. And then the time after that, I'll be back to self-avoiding walk, and I'll be talking about it on a special type of lattice. So there will be some reference to what's going on today, but it's minimal. And the time after that, I'll be taking care of mostly it's kind of algebraic manipulations, but in the last lecture I'll actually finally begin to try to do some analysis, and I'll do a little in the third as well. Mm-hmm. So let me begin here. What I want to explain today is some work by Parisi, Soulas, McCain, Luttinger. Those are all theoretical physicists, and Lejeune, probabilist, French probabilist, who together found a connection between the local times of a Markov process and Gaussian integration. Actually, it goes back further than that, but I just want to start with the history that's there. And you probably, the only credit I'll take here is explaining it in a way that you might possibly understand, because it's hard to get it out of the literature and to see what they're up to. So let me begin with discussion of just a general discussion of what self-avoiding walk and self-repelling walk are. So the self-avoiding walk with T-steps is a sequence of points on a simple cubic lattice. I don't know whether you can all see this, but two-dimensional simple cubic lattice. I'll just draw a little piece of it here. And a self-avoiding walk would be nearest neighbor steps, and the rule is don't ever come back to a place where you've already been, and make T steps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. T is 7 here. Yeah. So capital D is the dimension of the lattice that I'll be talking about. That's D equals 2 in that case. Now, what you can do with self-avoiding walk is to view them, all these self-avoiding walks, as geometrical objects, and you can sum over all of them and divide by the total number of them, just with T fixed, and that gives you an average. And using this average, which I've got this symbol here, physicist symbol right here for an average, you can ask, what is the expected end-to-end distance? Actually, this is the expected end-to-end distance squared. I'm taking the position of the walker after he's made the T-step, so right here in this case, and I'm taking this distance from here to here, and that's x sub t, and taking this to be the origin, and I'm squaring it, thinking of it as a vector and taking the norm squared, that's what I mean by squaring it, and taking the expectation of that. And then here's what is known already due to your distinguished colleague Gordon and his colleague Takashi Hara. If you're in dimension D greater than or equal to 5, then the growth of this end-to-end distance as you make the number of steps in the walk larger and larger is linear in T, which is, by the way, exactly the same as same type of law as you would have if there was no self-avoiding at all. If you just simply take what's called simple random walk on a lattice, where each step is made independently of the previous steps without regard to whether you've stepped on a site that's been there or not before, you will end up going square root of the number, your average distance away from the origin after t steps will be a constant times the square root of t. So the only way you can see that the self-avoidingness is actually playing a role if you're in five or more dimensions is that there's this constant here, and that constant would be different for the self-avoiding walk than it would be for the simple random walk. Now, if you're in four dimensions, you begin to see a hint that self-avoiding is playing a role. But this is a conjecture. Nobody knows how to prove this, but the theoretical physicists have a fairly well worked out idea of how one might go about proving this, and I'll be following their ideas in these lectures. And they say that there's a logarithmic correction, so it grows as t times log to the power of 1/4 times t in four dimensions. And then there are other conjectures for what happens in two dimensions. There's a rational power, and of T, and then there are numerical results in three dimensions. I won't go into those at all because I have no clue how to prove any of those. The two-dimensional one might be something that we can actually do one day, but three dimensions, I don't believe that there's really much of an idea in sight for at the moment. This little twiddle here has a kind of dubious, kind of dodgy little look about it, but it's precise. I want to use it in this sense here. That a function of t is asymptotic to another function of t if the ratio tends to 1 as t goes to infinity. Sorry, Mike. Right. Sure, great idea. Why not? I'm not really used to this. By the way, these colors, you know, I just discovered how to do color before I came here. I probably went overboard a bit. Maybe, can you see? You can't really, yeah, you can see them. Red means something appearing for the first time, and blue means something really sexy, and so on. So I want to just review what a finite state Markov process is. I have apologies to the probabilists who will yawn through this, but not everybody knows. So take a finite set of these lattice points I was referring to before. I really mean a finite set that's a connected finite set. Take a group of them that are near the place where you begin. The place where you begin I'm going to call A. Single those out and call them capital lambda. And then there's another ideal point called the graveyard added in. It has a rather gloomy look about it, but forget about it for the time being. I'll explain why that's there later. Now, a Markov process is a random function, x sub p. I can't see what I'm looking at here. X sub t, which is the position, your position in this state space. Lambda is called a state space. Is your position in the state space at time t. Now t is continuous in this formulation, so it belongs to the continuum. And the way you construct one of these random functions is you imagine yourself starting at this site A in the lattice, and then you wait for a random length of time, which is the same exponential weighting law as the law of radioactivity. You pick a random time, and then you decide to jump to one of the other sites in the lattice. And I won't insist that they be nearest neighbors anymore. I just have a general coefficients, aij, here. And what this says here is that the probability that you will find yourself at state j at time t plus dt, if you were at state I at time t, is proportional to the time interval dt times this coefficient aij, which is a positive number. And we want our probabilities to sum to 1, so these sums over, if you fix the I and sum over j of the aij, you should get a number which is either 1 or less than 1, and if it's less than 1, we add in this additional point called the graveyard, and that's where you've gone. Never mind. Oh. Now, one other thing. This is an infinitesimal law, the dt in there. It's a slightly informal way of saying it. There's clearly a limit as delta t goes to 0 involved in that statement there. There's an infinitesimal law, and then so that actually gives you a differential equation for various objects associated with the Markov process. And then if you want, you can find out what the probability that you'll start at some site A and then be at another site B in a finite time t. And that you get by after a calculation, it's maybe not quite obvious, but that is the exponential of this matrix A. That's what I'm saying here. And then I'm rewriting it a different way just to introduce some notation here. Instead of writing my probability x of t equals b, I'm going to do I'm going to take the function, this is the Kronecker delta. So this function is 1 when x sub t is equal to b and zero otherwise, and if I just integrate that function over the space of all possible histories, paths, which this Markov process can have, then that's the same as calculating the probability, integrating the characteristic function. This is a pretty big space that you're integrating over here, because the possible histories of this process are all piecewise constant functions of t. You can be at site A for a certain length of time, then you can be at another site next door or somewhere else in the lattice for another length of time, and so on. There's a lot of functions there, but probabilists are good. They know how to integrate over such big spaces. I didn't really appreciate measure theory too much when I was first exposed to it as a graduate student. It was only when I got into a course in probability that I realized that Lebesgue was really somebody fantastic. Now, let's talk about the local time here for a moment. This is something that will be appearing a lot in the rest of the lecture, so see if you can understand this. We take this function, this Kronecker delta, which is 1, and if you look at this, you'll see that it's a way of writing a function that's 1 for those times s such that the walk is at site I. So if I integrate that over the total length of time for which the walk is in existence, from 0 to t, I'll actually accumulate the total time that the, I said walk, but the Markov process, is at site I. See, it's a continuous time process, so you can imagine it. Let's suppose that this is the site I here. And we're not talking about a self-avoiding process yet or anything like that. It's free to, it starts somewhere and it makes a jump to some other site, and then it makes another jump to another site, and it jumps around like this. And it can come to this site I several times and then go on its way and come back. And you can accumulate the total length of, you can just work, define the tau to be the total time that it's in this state I out of the time interval 0 to capital T that we're looking at it for. Now, I'm going to study functions of this local time. The first one is kind of to get you warmed up on this. Suppose we have some numbers, V of I. So for every site in the lattice, you give me a number. This is V sub A, and then there's another number here. They're already pre-assigned. And then I want to work out this linear function of the local times. I'm just taking an arbitrary linear combination of the local times at different sites. Well, you can rewrite that as the integral from 0 to t of V evaluated at this random function x sub s, integrated over s. That's kind of easy, because all you do is to take this definition of tau here and stick it in, and then you'll see that there's an integral from 0 to t in the definition of tau, and there's also this sum over I right here, and you just interchange the integral and the sum, and because of this Kronecker delta, the sum only actually has one term in it, which is when I equals x sub s. So we evaluate V not at I, but at x sub s. And that's how we get that. Now, a similar type of calculation can be done for any polynomial in t. So I've got a quadratic function of, of tau. I've got a quadratic function of the local times here. And I can work out what that is by also just substituting in the definition of tau and seeing what I get. And what you get in this case is an integral, a double integral over time. And now the Kronecker delta is 1 when at time s you're in the same site as you are at time t. So if I were to integrate that, what I'm doing is I've got a measure here of how much time the walk spends intersecting itself. So coming back to this thing here, it's come back any time it comes back to the same site as it's already been, that delta function in that double integral there, Tonica delta, is going to be 1. And so you're just going to accumulate the total amount of time. It's a measure of how much time you spend in self-intersection, which is a useful thing to know if you're trying to talk about self-avoiding and other things. For instance, you could try to evaluate this integral here. We could try to take the expectation over all these Markov process, over all these possible histories of the Markov process, of e to the minus lambda I, and what would happen if you drove lambda to plus infinity in that formula? Well, actually, you'd get 0, typically you'd get 0, but as you drive it bigger and bigger, you'd be punishing more and more those walks that intersect themselves, and, I didn't mean to say you'd get 0. What you'd be doing if you drive lambda to infinity is punishing more and more the walks that intersect themselves and leaving behind the ones that don't intersect themselves. So this is a way of selecting out from all of these walks the ones that are self-avoiding. It's a little more complicated than I'm saying, but that's roughly the idea. And you could, for example, also evaluate this integral too. And that's the same, except that I put this end-to-end distance squared. And then if you took the ratio of the two, you would get something that I would define to be the expected end-to-end distance squared, but for what I'd call a self-repelling walk, because there is this weight that punishes those walks which spend a lot of time intersecting themselves. Now, I don't actually want to drive lambda to infinity. That's a slightly tricky limit. What I want to talk about for the rest of these lectures is when lambda is small. So it's actually an easier problem than the self-avoiding walk problem. But people believe that the log corrections that are conjectured for the self-avoiding walk are also present for this weakly self-repelling walk that I'm talking about. So it's kind of a step up to the main problem to do this. It preserves these log corrections, presumably. I mean the t, because I've said this rather badly. What I'm trying to say here is that I want to take the ratio, and then I want to let t get large, and I want to learn the asymptotic behavior as t gets large. And so, you see, I'd be finding the expected end-to-end distance of the self-avoiding walk for t very, very large. I shouldn't have really said take the limit. I just mean find the asymptotic behavior. So I want to show that there's this law, t log to the 1/4 t law in this. Now, to avoid you all being very disappointed, let me say I'm not going to be able to do that. This is a conjecture that these log corrections are there in four dimensions. It's even a conjecture for this weakly self-avoiding walk. But what I'll end up doing in the last couple of lectures is discussing another type of lattice, which is four-dimensional in a certain sense, for which one can prove that there are these log corrections. But it's a much easier problem. The reason why I'm telling you about this stuff and ending up with that is that this is possibly a way to do the four-dimensional problem, but I think we're a long way away from being able to do that, as I stated it. But there are some nice things along the way. I'd like to begin showing you one of them now. So there's this connection with differential forms. And let me remind you about differential forms, because even probabilists who know all about everything I've said so far don't always find differential forms so completely familiar. So imagine you've got a complex number phi, u plus iv, or two variables, u plus iv, and then you can differential of phi is du plus idv, and the differential of the conjugate of phi is du minus idv, and then when you multiply forms together, you're using this wedge product, but I'm not writing the wedge product in there. There is secretly a wedge product between every pair of forms that I multiply. But all you have to remember is that they anti-commute. du dv is minus dv du. This is the Cartan calculus of differential forms. So, and du du is 0. So then you can compute d phi conjugate, and in this bracket, only the cross terms will survive because du du is 0 and dv dv is 0, so you get minus 2i du dv. Just keep that in mind for a second, and it'll crop up a little later. Now, what I want to do is to show you lots of interesting ways of writing the number 1. If that's not too elementary for you. But, you know, you can write 1 as e to the 2 pi I, and that's pretty neat, I think. This is also a lot of neat ways of writing 1. So, let's take an arbitrary positive number A, and then look what I'm doing here. I've got the exponential of a differential form. Differential form is just has a form part, and that it's a differential form is just a polynomial in d phi. And you can the most complicated polynomial that you can write in d phi would have a part that is of degree 0, just a function of phi. So I'm choosing phi a phi bar for that. And then you could have linear ones, d phi's, and you could have something times a d phi and something times a d phi bar, and leaving those out. And then you can have something quadratic. Now, how do you define the exponential of a form? Well, what you do is you simply make a Taylor expansion. You expand around the part of the form which is of degree 0. So keep that there and make a Taylor expansion as if this was an ordinary number around this part of degree 0. But you see the Taylor expansion will always terminate because you can't square d phi and you can't square d phi bar without getting 0. So the worst that can happen is that you have two terms in this case. Now the next thing is that integrals, see we don't write any d phi's here because they're already there. In this integral. By convention, every integral is an integral over some space, and this is an integral over the complex plane. It's a two-dimensional integral over the real part and the imaginary part in the complex plane. These integrals, by convention, only select the form which matches their dimension, so a form of degree 2. So it actually ignores the 1, and so you're left with this integral here. Exponential of something quadratic in phi, and then d phi a d phi bar. And at that point, we can all evaluate that integral, and you end up with 2 pi I. And the main point is that it's independent of a. What happened was that the a in here provided just the right Jacobian to get rid of the a there. And then what I'll do is I'll get rid of this 2 pi I by replacing A by A twiddle in this formula here. I just don't want to keep writing lots of 2 pi I's all over the place. And you can put it somewhere or somewhere else, but you all know that 2 pi I's can't be totally avoided in this world. So that's good enough for the time being. Now, next thing is that that's silly little two-dimensional integral has a fairly nice generalization. Let's first stick with what we were talking about there. If you just evaluate a slight variation, the S is what I said before. It's exactly the same. So this part of the new part of the integral is written in red here, the phi phi bar. Just add that into the integral. If you do that by the same rules, you will get 1 over the number A. Now, showing you how that works in some detail, but what I won't show you now, right now, in great detail, is that exactly the same thing is true if phi is a vector with n components, capital N components, and A is an n by n matrix. The only thing I would want now is that the A be a positive definite matrix so that my integrals will converge. Because you'll get a Gaussian in e to the minus something quadratic in phi when you do this, and I want that to be a positive definite form. Now, all integrals go from minus infinity to infinity. Yes, so all integrals are over. So this is an integral here over the complex plane C to the N. That didn't come out too well, did it? Let me see if I can find another pencil here. Ah, great, thanks. Try that. So, R to the 2N, that's what that integral is over there. I'm not going to prove that, just tell you that that's true. But later on in the lecture, if I have time, I'll leave that there. I will prove that. So you can actually invert a matrix by this formula. You can, starting from matrix A, you can write, by this I mean the inverse of the matrix A. So let me write that up here. The vector generalization that I'm talking about is that the integral of e to the minus s, which is still that quadratic thing, phi A, phi bar, and d phi A, d phi bar, is 1. And e to the minus s phi a phi b gives you cab. I'm going to use c a lot. C is always going to be the inverse of a. C stands for covariance. C is the covariance of some Gaussian integral, and it's always the inverse of the matrix. That appears up there. So notice none of these integrals are normalized because they're already normalized by the Gaussian form. That's going to be useful in a while. Right, now we have what's called the Feynman-Katz formula, which is a very well-known thing. And I'm not going to prove this, I'm just going to state it in the form I need it. Give yourself the exponential of a linear combination of variables t1 to tn. T's are really the local times in a moment. And what you can do is you can regard this V as a diagonal matrix. So it's V1, V2, down to Vn. Whoops, writing on the thing like that. And that's what I mean on this side. You take your matrix A that I've already talked about. It's both the inverse of C and it's also the generator of the Markov process. You add this diagonal part to it, V, and then I'm computing in the sense of matrices the exponential of this matrix, and I want the A comma B matrix entry. But you can also get that by taking this integral, this average over this huge space of all possible histories of the Markov process. And you see this delta function here means that I'm actually integrating over histories where at the beginning of time you're at A, and at the end of time, when capital T is capital T, you're at state B. And I've just wedged in this the new feature here, corresponding to this red guy over here, is this function of local times there. That's the Feynman-Katz formula. Now you can integrate that from 0 to infinity over capital T, and when you integrate e to the minus t, A, you get 1 over A. So I'm writing the inverse of the matrix A plus B on this side, and on this side I've got this integral. So this is a way to, again, write the inverse of a matrix. So remember now we've got two ways of writing the inverse of a matrix. Either by doing a Gaussian integral with forms in it, which is what we're doing on this thing here, or by doing something probabilistic. And that leads to the following theorem. Let me leave that up. Which I will call the tau isomorphism. So this is this theorem which I would like to credit to Parisi, Suolas, McCain, Luttinger, and Lejeune. Lejeune was the one who pointed out that pointed out to me a long, long time ago that these Grassmann variables that appear in the physics literature are really just differentials. I think that's a nice thing to know, because they look a bit mysterious, but they don't look so mysterious when you do it this way. And it also suggests a manipulation which you wouldn't have thought of otherwise. So here it is. We have something probabilistic and something Gaussian. And tau appears on both sides. But tau means something very different on each side. On the probabilistic side, it is the local time that I was talking about. And on the Gaussian side, it's this differential form here. It's sort of like the forms that I've already been looking at. There's a phi, phi bar part and a d phi bar part. And the new feature is that this f can be just any function you like. The only thing is it's got to be just smooth. So you see, I've got to define a function of forms. Remember, to define a function of forms, I have to expand it out in the Taylor series around the degree zero part. And this is always a terminating Taylor series. And the form is of degree, is of an even form, so there's never any trouble in deciding what order to write the terms in the Taylor series, because these, although they anti-commute, they're even. There's no what's called factor ordering problem in writing it out. This is a theorem which probabilists might recognize has some kinship to what's called the Dynkin isomorphism. This is much more elementary in one sense, in that it's only finitely many states, and yet on the other hand rather nice in another sense. It's actually a much more precise isomorphism because of this extra part. Now the proof is really simple. I don't know whether you'll catch it right now, but it is really as simple as I've got here. Basically, we have already proved it, because we know that we've already proved it in a special case. We know that we can write the inverse of a matrix as something Gaussian, and we know that we can write it, the inverse of a matrix, as something probabilistic. So if you think about what that means, it tells you that you've already proved this formula here in the special case where f is the exponential of vi times tau I. See, here is the f, and it's exponential, and that's what you need to do the Feynman-Katz formula. So you've already got it in that case. And then the point is that once you have it for exponentials, since the capital F appears in a linear way on both sides of the equation, you also have it for arbitrary combinations of exponentials. And there aren't too many functions you can't reach by taking combinations of exponentials. For instance, more or less any function can be written as the Fourier transform of its Fourier transform, and that's a thought. So that writes it as an exponential as a linear combination of exponentials. So obviously there's some analytic details I'm leaving out there, but that's the basic idea. So if you give me a question in probability which concerns local times, then I can transform it into a question about Gaussian integrals of functions of forms. That's basically the content of this. I think it's really a nice theorem. It has a very simple proof. I leave it up there, but still, it's cute. So let me just summarize how this tau isomorphism is going to come in handy in the grand program. I can choose my function of local times to be anything I like. So I'm going to choose it to be e to the minus lambda times this capital I. Now, you may have forgotten that this capital I was the thing that accumulated the total self-intersection time. So it was the sum over tau I squares. This isn't too good either, is it? See if I got a better one. I'll end up going through all of these. Try this one. Okay. And then I've thrown in this extra thing in red here. That's the linear combination of taus. And the reason for that is because then it'll give rise to this red thing here. If you cover up for a second, see, I want to calculate that. I want to calculate, remember, the idea was to calculate the ratio of two things that look like that. Exponential of e to the minus local time e to the minus lambda times the time of spent in intersection. I want to calculate that type of integral. And what I can do by means of this tau isomorphism is I can calculate the Laplace transform of that. The reason why those guys give rise to e to the minus beta t here is that the sum of the local times has to be the total time. Once you know that it's the local time, you can take it outside the integral because that's no longer a random thing, and you just factor it out and you get this Laplace transform. We have to, according to this program, we can calculate the Laplace transforms of the things we're interested in by doing Gaussian integrals with forms in them. Laplace transforms are hard to invert, so that's actually going to be a nasty problem, which will rear its ugly little head later, but still, this is something. The S that appears in this Gaussian integral has these quadratic things. The A is how it knows about the transition probabilities of the Markov process. Then there's this time of intersection here, and there's this beta that I added in, and the tau is still this quadratic form here. Well, let me leave that up. So the transform problem, the original weakly repelling random walk problem, is to evaluate this type of an integral. But the kicker is that you have to do it uniformly in the number of states in the Markov process, because we want to let this thing run for a real long time. When it runs for a real long time, it's going to have the freedom to walk a real long way. Otherwise, of course, you can't prove. You can't prove anything by keeping it locked up in a finite state region. So you have to let it go all over the place. You need really an infinite lattice. But on the other hand, I can't use this isomorphism for an infinite lattice. I don't really know what that means yet. So what we have to do to substitute for that is to get an extreme amount of uniformity in the number of sites in the lattice. So we need a way of evaluating these types of integrals uniformly in the dimension of the integral. And that's actually the sort of thing that people in constructive quantum field theory have been struggling with for years. And it's also the sort of thing that the theoretical physicists have worked out well-developed ways to think about. So we have a lot going for us in this program. Now, I'm just going to briefly, this is not going to help you that much, but I just want to show you that the basic way to do this, and this is what I'll be talking about in future lectures, is what's called the Laplace approximation to an integral. You can calculate the exponential of minus alpha, and you can have a more or less arbitrary function of s, arbitrary function of the phi, variables phi here. The only rule is that you want it to have a non-degenerate global minimum. And then the deal is that when this number lambda, when this number alpha here is very, very large, the type of function you're integrating looks terribly like this. Because it's the exponential of a function that looks like that. And there's a big number here. And when it starts to look really like that, because you make the alpha bigger and bigger, then you have a shot at writing some pretty nice formulas, and those formulas are the formulas which we can try to use for evaluating this integral. And where this number big alpha is going to come from and so on, well, really that's I've written it in a slightly unfamiliar way, but it's actually the same as the problem I had before, because when you take this number alpha very large, what you really do is you select the quadratic part of S as the leading part, and anything that's not quadratic, like quartic, is a very tiny perturbation to it. And that's actually the same problem as I had before. So some rapid words there, that just to give you an idea of what we will try to do later. And then, actually, I'm supposed to give a lecture in the DCS series, and I will talk about, at some length, I'll talk about how to do what I was just explaining, if you were curious. The great thing is that you can develop an asymptotic series, and the coefficients in the series are developed in a dimension-independent way. The formulas just don't depend on the dimension. Now, then you can check whether or not the coefficients in this asymptotic series are in fact uniform in the dimension. And if they are, then you have grounds for believing that you have an approximation that's uniform in the dimension, although it may be very hard to prove that. And that's the sort of, that's where the theoretical physicists are. They know that they have these objects, they can develop them in formal asymptotic series, they can check term by term in the series that the coefficients are uniform in the number of dimensions, and so they leave it to us to figure out whether or not that's actually a uniform approximation. Now, I want to just come back to what we were doing before. I want to show you in the last 10 minutes or so why these integrals give you inverses of matrices, why they're self-normalizing. And this is a cute thing which I learned from a paper by Witten. So this is kind of a thumbnail sketch of something called supersymmetry, and since people are often curious about that, I thought it might be an appropriate thing to mention in this context here. In fact, it's the origin of this self-normalizing property. So here we go. We have this space C sub n, and we have this complex vector, phi, with n components. And what I can do is I can multiply every one of those components by the same e to the I theta. Like that. And I'm going to leave out this factor of 2 pi I because it makes a mess of all the formulas, but it'll pop up in various places. Now, of course, once you do a change of variables like that, you can also, it induces some action on forms, and d phi transforms to e to the minus I theta. Probably need a minus sign here. It just transforms d phi to e to the minus theta d phi, and of course d phi bar to e to the plus I theta d phi. And then you can take derivatives of the spector theta, that's an infinitesimal flow, and you have something called the Lie derivative in differential geometry when you do that. That's a very lowbrow definition of the Lie derivative. And if we do it here, of course, we will find that just the Lie derivative, which is by definition the derivative of this flow at theta equals zero, is just multiplying d phi by minus I. So then we can say a form is invariant if the Lie derivative acting on the form is zero. That means it's invariant under the flow. Let me leave that up. Now, where's my stuff gone? Then we need something else called the interior product. Here it is. I'm sorry, this is called I as well. It's not the square root of minus 1. Anything with an underline underneath is a much more grand thing than the square root of minus 1. Now, the interior product, basically in differential geometry, any time you're given a vector field, you can define something called the interior product. And I'm taking as my vector field the one that generates this flow, where you just multiply each phi by e to the I minus I theta, and I'm just telling you what the formulas are in that special case. So let me just make it a definition, because those of you who know what the interior product are know what I'm talking about, and those of you who don't can just live with this formula here. The interior product on d-phi changes the d-phi, which is a form of degree 1, down to a function, a form of degree 0. And here's the rule. And then once you know how it acts on d-phi and d-phi bar, then you define it on products of d-phi and d-phi bar by saying it must be an antiderivative, which means that it obeys Leibniz rules with minus signs in it. Every time you commute an I past a d-phi, you have to put in a minus sign. And then there's the formula from differential geometry that says that that Lie derivative I had a moment ago is actually given by this, where d is called the exterior derivative, di plus id. Won't say more about that. And this implies that the L, that the Lie derivative, has a square root, namely d plus I. If you square d plus I, because d squared is 0, and actually I squared is 0 too, because of that you only get the cross terms, and those cross terms are the Lie derivative. So the Lie derivative has a square root called Q. That's called the supersymmetry generator in physics. And then the function S, okay, so I'm back to this thing that looks like this, phi A phi bar plus d phi A d phi bar. That is actually exact in the sense that if you apply this Q to it, you will get 0, and S is Q of something else. So here, you see, if you take Q and you apply it to phi I d phi bar j, just work it out using those rules, you get a part which is phi I phi j, which is what's inside this phi A phi bar, and you get another part, d phi bar, which is inside that, and you can work that up into an argument that S is actually Q of something. And Q squared is 0 because S is invariant. S is invariant, and Q squared is the Lie derivative, and the Lie derivative is 0. So Q squared is 0. It's a very familiar thing, sounding thing. Then we have the following deformation property of integrals. If you give me any differential form U, which is odd and is its invariant, then I take my S and I add to it T times Q of something, this Q of anything. This integral actually won't depend on the T. I'll prove that in a second, but just believe it for a moment. The only rule is that this a thing you've added on must not destroy the integrability of e to the minus s. So what we can do as a consequence of that is we can choose the t and the qu in such a way that it cancels the diagonal parts, the off-diagonal parts of s. You see, the s here has an a, ij, phi I, phi j in it, and there's another part which is d, phi I, a, I, j, d, phi. Ooh, damn, sorry, it's off the... Sorry about that. Now, the point is that I can just choose the Q, as I have over here. Choose this Q, that's a form which is invariant and which is odd. And I can choose it in such a way as to cancel the A, I, j when I is not equal to j. Which means that A is reduced to being a diagonal matrix. And if A is a diagonal matrix, then I have a product of one-dimensional integrals for which I've already proved it. So you get this result here. And then, I won't show you, but the matrix result is similar. I mean, the getting the inverse of the matrix is similar. And actually, you get a generalization of this. It doesn't really matter that you have the exponential of t times qu. The proof I'll show you would work for more general functions as well as exponentials. And because of that, you can prove that any time you have just some function of local times, it's as if you set all the local times to zero. Physicists refer to this as taking the number of components of a field theory to zero. So they act, in other words, physicists say that really the integral over the forms cancels the, well, they have Grassmann variables and And Grassmann integration and ordinary integration were too cancel out in their view. But it looks kind of simple, this way of doing things. It's nice, I think. You leave that there. Sorry, I made some incomprehensible statements there. But here's a proof of, or the beginning of a proof of what I'm claiming. For any differential form u, the integral of q of u is zero. This sort of reminds us of the integral of d of u is zero. And in fact, that's part of it. The integral of d of u is zero because Stokes' theorem transforms that to the integral of d of something is the integral over the boundary. Now, this is all of space, so what we need is a form which decays to zero rapidly at infinity so that when you approximate the integral by a finite integral and take its limit, the boundary term gives you nothing. So the integral of d of u is zero, and it's also true for a much more trivial reason that the integral of I, the interior product acting on u, is also zero. And the trivial reason is this. The integral is looking for a form of degree 2n, because it's an integral of dimension 2n, and you can't have a form of degree 2n after you've lowered whatever you did have by 1. Because no form is of degree higher than 2n, because you can't multiply enough d phis together to get a form of degree higher than 2n, because you'll always have the square of a d phi or a d phi bar somewhere, which is zero. So q of u integrates to zero. And then, here's the proof of this invariance principle, so I'm just going to prove this for you now. I need enough decay so that I can differentiate under the integral. Differentiate under the integral, and you get, now notice, this u was a form of odd degree. It would be tricky to work out the exponential of a form of odd degree and whether it differentiates in the normal way that exponentials should, because they anti-commute and you're not sure that the rules for exponentials are fair anymore when you've got anti-commuting numbers. But if you apply q to it, q is always a form of even degree. So then you make your Taylor series expansion, and these forms of even degree commute with each other, and all the normal rules for differentiating still work just the same way. So I can differentiate the exponential as if it were an exponential, getting qu. Qu commutes with the exponential here. Then you can take the q out to the front. Why? Because it's a derivation. And if you actually apply it to the exponential, you will get q of s, which is zero, and you'll get q squared, which is zero, because s is invariant and q squared is zero. So you get nothing. So this derivative with respect to t is zero. So that shows you that the original integral here does not depend on t. That's where I'll stop today. Sitting in stunned amazement. Yes.
On the first slide, you were just talking about your dimensions and the estimates for how expectation value of x squared is. Is it possible to do something for non-degree dimensions?
Yes. It's really interesting, actually. So the question is, could we do something for non-integral dimensions? Could we study lattices where the dimension of the lattice is not an integer but fractional in some sense? Now, what I would not know how to do easily is the sort of thing that Martin knows how to do, to have fractals. But what you can do, which is a very interesting thing to do in its own right, is you can change the jumping rule of the process in such a way that it thinks it's in a different dimension. And I'll actually give a definition of what it means by that. So, for instance, you could take a process on a three-dimensional lattice, and you can change the jumping rule so it takes big jumps, being a Levy process. And then various functions scale as if they're in four dimensions. And then these methods actually tell you something about that type of process. And the nice thing about that is you can actually vary the dimension continuously, so you can kind of work near four dimensions.
Will then there be a critical dimension where it stops feeling like T and begins feeling like T times something else?
Exactly, yes. Four is the critical dimension for that reason. Yeah. And you can see rather precisely what the bifurcation is as you vary the fractional dimension. I'm talking about things that actually have not been done for self-avoiding walk problems, but have been done in field theory here. But I believe that they will work in the same way for self-avoiding walk problems.
You quoted the results for four and five and more than you mentioned there's a numerical experiment
in three, right?
And another
two. Yeah. Two is really nice because there's a connection to conformal invariance in two. Well, it gives you a number which I don't remember right now. Maybe Gordon knows it off the top of his head. 0.588. Thank you. Nobody really knows how to get this number in any other way than just to do the experiment. Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm actually saying something very wrong there. What the physicists have done is to make this fractional dimension argument that we were talking about a moment ago, and they've just arbitrarily set the dimension equal to 3 in their expansions, and they've done various things where you get expansion to a high order, and then you can kind of extrapolate to what it should be. And it gives pretty good answers.
So that's the power.
That's the power.
T to the power.
Right. But this looks like a really hard problem at the moment. There aren't really very many new ideas in what I'm talking about. I'm just taking what the physicists tell me should work, and I'm making sure they do. If you take a simple random walk, the distinction is this, that a simple random walk will with probability 1 intersect itself finitely often on either side of a given time, and if it's in 5 or more dimensions. But in less than 5 dimensions, it will intersect itself infinitely often on either side of a given time. And so for that reason, the interaction in low dimensions is really big compared with the interaction in high dimensions. It's just got more room to not come back to itself in high dimensions.
Sorry,
yes.
Sure. A three-dimensional behavioral speed squared average is proportional to
T. To the power of 2 times 0.5. So what was it again? Gordon,
0.5.
Yeah, because people talk about the end-to-end distance rather than the square of the end-to-end distance.
Three quarters? Is it not calculated because there is a relation right to the model?
Yes, exactly. There is such, and so there's an exact prediction. Is it 3/4?
2 times 3/4.
It's a nice rational number, and I think it's 3/4. So this is something that actually is conceivable, one that somebody soon will prove. And this one here, in 3 dimensions, I think there's just not an idea, really, to how to do that yet.
Mathematical
proof, I mean, yeah. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. No, I mean, one can know what the answer is. For example, people knew for a long time what the answer to Fermat's last theorem was, but it was quite a strain to prove it.
This is a good place to wrap it up, so let's thank David again. Just a reminder that there's a very simple graduate center.